LNE Volume 3, a video by the great Franklin Carbonati, spanning Rome, Milan, London, New York, Paris, Barcelona, Montreal, and Toronto, featuring Rebo, Volvo, Snens, MTNW, Anger, Talker, Xavier, BO South, Lure, Rehab, Time, Zonic, XSM, Kemto, Salon, TD, Emno, Fayer, Toser, Nove, Stays, Villo, OSF, Waste, Soul, Zano, Guko, and What. The full video is now available on our Patreon. Enjoy, peace, love, and respect. So we were going to start with, how did you initially start writing graffiti, and when was it?
Shit. All right, let's see. Man, it's a pleasure to be here. Definitely fuck with you guys' episodes, and you guys are doing a real service to the graffiti community. Let's see. I started writing in... Well, you know what? Let me take it back. I started, like, noticing graffiti, like, in, like, 80-something, like, 87, 88. I grew up in 137th Street, close to Riverside. And I went to a school called 192, and there was, like, a Hall of Fame there. And inside this Hall of Fame, there would be people like West and FC Crew would do stuff, and I would see some of their... But you know what? Before that, it was, like, other, like, old-school writers. And I would, like, try to, like, draw the stuff. I didn't know anything about graffiti. It was around me, and I knew there was graffiti everywhere, but I just didn't really, you know... I wasn't really interested. I was interested in cartoons and comic books. That's what I was interested in, video games. But the first graffiti thing I ever saw that I was like, oh shit, this is really good. I saw a train piece. I think it was a guy by name Sun. Sun One, maybe. He did a Donkey Kong whole train. And it had Donkey Kong and Mario on it. And I was like, and you know, I love video games. I love comic books. I'm like, that's dope. So that was like the first little spark. After that... I moved to the Bronx, probably, like, I don't even know what year, maybe 89, and I moved to Kingsbridge in university, and I was hanging out with my friend, my boy Jay, my boy Kiko, and we were just doing, like, hood stuff, just playing, like, football in the concrete, manhunt, climbing fire escapes, doing, like, fake jumpings. Like, just all types of crazy shit. And we would just make up things to do every day. This is when, like, we would just hang in front of the building on 192. And there was famous graffiti. I started learning about graffiti through that neighborhood. So the famous graffiti writers in that time was, like, Says RK. This guy named Owen. He was famous for my area, but he wasn't really that up like that. All City or anything like that. But Owen. There was a dude that wrote Wreck. Wreck FT. So Wreck FT is the first graffiti that I was like, holy shit, this guy's everywhere. And I try to like copy his style. He had a nice script hand style. And there was like Fifth and Dreb, TNG people. And they were just neighborhood graffiti. And I wasn't really going that far, so I didn't really know how up they were. But in my neighborhood, they were everywhere. And of course, Cope was up, you know, everywhere at that time. Then... me and my friends, like, came up with, like, you know, hey, let's all give each other tags. And we found a spray can, and we went to the roof, and we started tagging. Or we went to, like, Metro North Line. And that shit felt like an adventure at that time. But I didn't consider myself a graffiti writer. It was, like, 91, 92. But I saw graffiti. And then I think my first tag was, like, Shame. And then my friend was like, nah, you know, you can't write that. So I didn't know anything about graffiti. And when I went to school... I saw subway art. They had it at the library, and I stole it from the library, and that's it. Everyone else was, like, not a real writer, really, or we were all toys, but when I stole subway art, and I was like, oh, shit, there's different caps, and there's this, and there's, like, a real subculture, I was like, I'm in. At that time, I wanted to be a comic book artist. I was drawing every single day to be a comic book artist. Like, my idols were, like, Todd McFarlane, Jim Lee, Arthur Adams, old school artists. So those were the people I fucked with, and I wanted to be a comic book artist. But once I saw subway art, everything changed, and I started reading Source magazine, and Chino was doing it and having all the old school guns. I started just learning every day, learning. And then around that time, I met my boy NB40, and I met Saze, RK, and I met Part 5. Those guys were like celebrities to me. Like Saze, RK had all the 4 line, all the 6 line, 2 and a 5, all that. And these guys were like larger than life characters. And I remember I was like, yo, I write graph and I want to write with you guys. And they took me out. I remember Part 5 and NB40 took me out. And I remember we bombed the 4 line that day. We hit some rocks. And I remember my boy NB40 like almost fell off the rocks. And, you know, I held him and like, you know, like, he would have fell like far. At the end of the night, he was like, yo, I got a confession to tell you. The only reason we took you out is that we were going to rob you. We were going to put you on a rooftop and rob you for all your paint. But after you, like, saved my life, like, I was like, ah, nah, you're somebody, you know, I can fuck with you. I was like, damn. But at the time, I didn't know anything about, like, being a graffiti writer or, like, what it is, like gang shit. I thought graffiti was some friendly artist community because I would just read the source and I would see, like, Tats Crew and FX Crew, and I thought it was, like, a hokey-dokey community. I didn't, you know, and I thought like all that gang shit was some LA shit, like Crips and Bloods. I didn't know, but NB40 told me, because I was like, I would show him all my art, and he's like, yeah, but that you got to get good with hand style. You got to get good with bombing. He said, nobody respects those people that just paint like little murals. You got to get like, get your respect from street bombing. So I went from someone who wanted to be like a member of Tats Crew or like some muralist to like a street bomber. And that's when I started like, paying my respects to street bombing and focus on it. And Saze, RK, Nex and 3B, my boy Hefs, NB40, Part 5. These were the people that were up around my area and like, you know, taught me the game. And then at that time, I started learning about racking at that time too. And that changed a lot of stuff, so.
So take me through, so you started writing, you started getting influenced by all the things that you were seeing around you. What do you think that did for your life at that time period? What do you think are the things that it introduced you to? Do you see it as a mainly positive thing? And then how did the whole racking thing start?
Shit, whole racking thing, let me see. It definitely wasn't a good influence. But I mean, at the time it wasn't. In the, you know, if you pan out, it is, you know. On some cryptocurrency, it's not doing well now, but if you pan out long term, but shit, I my mom thought I was a straight gang member writing graffiti, and she kicked me out. I moved in with my boy MB40, and then I didn't have any money, but I was like stealing markers and stealing paint. And he was like, yo, you see this stuff that we're doing right now? We're racking paint from like Caldors or, you know, our Target or whatever, Walmart, whatever it was at the time. If you can steal this, you can make money. I'm like, what? He's like, the same techniques we're using for stealing spray paint or stealing a marker, we can make money. And then he put me onto something called loot racking, like loot. And then that's everything changed after that. I don't like using the word stealing because I feel like stealing is what crackheads do. Like we use racking. So we were racking like Tylenol, Primatene Mist, Polaroid cameras, Polaroid film, batteries, all that shit. And then, you know, you would take it to like a fence, but like graffiti writers don't use the word fence. We use the word bumpy. At least the people in New York do. And we would take it to a bumpy. And so maybe the first time I went racking, I made like $50. But I was like, oh shit. And then the second time I went racking, I made $150. And then it kept escalating. And then I fucking loved it because I didn't realize that there was like a hidden level. I felt like you were playing like Super Mario and you fucking broke through the fucking ceiling and then there was another level of shit that you had no idea about. So I was interested in graffiti and I might realize that there's this whole subculture of racking and there's like heroes in the racking world and there's all these like special items and kind of like it was a game of like you had to use your mind and like the more creative you were, the more you thought about it, the more money you can make. And so, and then at that time, like I learned, at that time, somebody told me something. I don't even know who told me it. The best writers, the best graffiti writers are rackers. He's like, everybody you think that is the best, trust me, they're a racker. He's like, there's something that is like the balls it takes to rack, the consistency, the guile. It just, it just crafts you into this fucking ultimate machine for graffiti. So, shit, it totally changed my life. I went from, like, you know, I was working like a supermarket in Christie's. I quit that shit because I was making like $4.25 an hour. And here I'm making like, you know, like $200 a day, racking $300 a day. And then we got into like Infamil, we call it powders, the Infamil milk. It's the stuff you give. It's like the powder for breastfeeding. We got into that. That was big. That was big in the Bronx.
Really?
Huge. I think every writer in New York City did that. And the Bumpy we went to was on Burnside, 183rd. Legendary Bumpy. Shout out to you, guy. You paid my rent for many years. Shout you out, definitely, Bumpy. But, yeah, the yellow Infamil. And my boy Remo BTB is the first person I seen racking Infamil. I saw him. We were chilling with him, me and MB40. We were on the 183rd, and they wanted to go smoke weed, and he had no money. So he went to the supermarket, came out with two fucking cans of fucking Infamil down his leg, two or three of them. Went to the bodega and came out with money, like $20 or something. And I was like, what the fuck? Did you just sell that? And he's like, yeah, I sold that shit. And he's like, my boy Ashy put me on. And then I was like, I was already racking. So I started racking. And so every supermarket had that shit. So every supermarket I was filling up my EMS book bag, 12, 17 powders here. And I was racking as much as I can carry because I didn't have a car. So 17 powders here, maybe 12, 13 powders in each thing. Go back and sell it. And if I still have time, go do the same thing again downtown. Queens, we loved Queens. It is true. Queens gets the money because I made so much money in Queens. Flushing, especially Flushing. Any racker who's listening to this knows about Queens back in the day. It was lovely. That Genovese with the two exits. Ah. But, that changed my whole thing. So I was really more interested in racking, and graffiti was like some side shit that I did. But at the time we were chilling, you know, I was chilling with like TDK crew and writers from the Bronx. And then my boy Part 5 took me to Manhattan. And when he took me to Manhattan, shit, man, it changed everything. He was like he worked at Revlon or some shit, or he was all over Manhattan. I didn't know anything about Manhattan writers. So I remember he was like, yo, the first person he put me onto was like Trake and MQ. He's like, yo, these guys are everywhere. This is like 1994, 1995. And Trake, they had the most tags. And at the time, I still didn't have a good hand style. I was still like learning. And then I realized that like, yeah, I kind of was like, you know, I like racking, but I want to be like the way these dudes are. Trake and MQ, those dudes are like my hero. And especially at that time on the West Side Highway, I mean, I was just, you know, I was still learning about everything. And, you know, I got put on, like, I think J.A. just came out with that article in Rolling Stone magazine. And he had all the throw-ups. It was like J.A. and J.D., the back-to-backs. And then MQ came and dissed all of them. And he did MQs. And then he did a giant MQ throw-up with, like, fangs. And he was, like, eating the J.A. throw-ups. And that shit. And it was so fucking high. And this is not like now everybody's using those jetpacks or whatever the fuck you call them. Mm-hmm. Nobody had that shit. These guys had huge ladders, and that shit blew my mind. And so I started getting back into graffiti. So I would say like racking led me, it kind of like enhanced or accelerated my interest in graffiti.
And when you say racking, it's not like the way you're explaining it, it's not like how a lot of writers rack. They rack just paint supplies, graph supplies, and maybe you know, some food here and there. Some you're racking on a different level. You're making a living off of this. This the purpose is not just getting paint. The purpose is becoming to make money.
Well, is it to make money? I mean, at the same time, I got into so many different things around 94, 95. I got into like gear, clothes. I got into like polo, low. We got into North Face jackets. Because we were racking North Face jackets. And I'm not going to say I was like some original lowlife. Absolutely not. I think like low hit the Bronx kind of late. But North Face was big in my circle. Especially the people, my boy MB40, Part 5, C's. They don't get enough recognition. But like they pioneered that whole kind of writers. At least in the Bronx wearing North Face. North Face has its own lore, I think, tied to like the lowlifes from Brooklyn and especially a lot of RFC people. I feel graffiti is like a game of, what's that shit called, telephone? Mm. Where like the story kind of changes depending on who you're talking to or as you go along. But according to like the way I've heard it is like there's a writer named Colors for RFC, rap, North Face. And then all the other people started wearing it. And then I think the first person I saw wearing a North Face is my boy either Ed TBK or Sabe KST. I saw them wearing polo and stuff. And so like graffiti, there was like all these sub levels that I just didn't know about. It was just like racking. And then everybody was into clothes and gear. So it was like not only did you have to do your graffiti and be good at that, you had to do racking and be really good at that. And on top of that, you had to rack clothes and look super fly. So like polo, like all the low stuff, all the, you know, cashmere teddies, the sit down teddy bears, like, you know, Snow Beach, all that shit was big. I was like, I fucking thought about it all night. And North Face jackets, it was something that I would rack it, but I was really collecting it, like on some Pokemon shit. I wanted every color, I wanted every style of North Face. And North Face, you could not get, you couldn't get North Face in any store. They didn't have it on Fordham Road. They didn't have it in the Bronx. I think one store in Manhattan sold it, Tin and Trails. And then a little bit later on, Eastern Mountain Sports. But you had to go out of state to get it. And so when you saw a rider and he had a North Face jacket on and he had a mountaineering bag, well, I mean, not even a rider, a person. I knew you wrote. I knew you wrote 100%. You got a yellow mountain, old school mountain. You got a JanSport, Super JanSport book bag or EMS bag. You're wearing some mountaineering boots with North Face pants. Like, it was just, you know, but at the same time, it was kind of like, okay, this guy's kind of like, it's like, you know that he's done his homework. There was no eBay really at that time. The only way you could get it through is like something called deals. Like you trade. And so it was like, dude, it was like my own world of fucking Warcraft or some fucking my own role-playing game that I was playing every day.
So when this like took place, like from the beginning, I'm assuming it was like late teens, like early 20s, kind of all this kind of going on. What was it like with your family? Like, it assumed like, assuming that like your ambitions weren't to go to have like a normal career, it seemed like you were hanging out with people that like you seen a different, you know what I mean, opportunity in a way to like a direction in life. So how did that play out with like, you know, the people around you essentially?
Shit. I mean, I moved out at 17 years old. My mom kicked me out, really. But, and then I moved out. So like after that, my family was an afterthought. Like I just didn't, to me, all I thought about was racking, graffiti, clothing. We didn't even think about girls back then. We just like, you know, we just thought about like, you know, props, you know, like just fucking getting up and just having a good time and shit. And, but as for my family, I don't know. They probably thought I was on some gang shit, weird shit. The reality is I wasn't. I was like a mad nerdy kid that loves video games. I was watching anime before people were watching that shit. I wasn't like a bad kid. I was like going to church and shit. But, yeah, man, it's I just got obsessed with graffiti and all the subcultures attached to it. So man, it took me to like areas that were like totally like I never expected and crazy missions. And a lot changed. So when I met Earsnot in 1996 or 1997, and a lot changed once that happened, because then I wasn't chilling in the Bronx that much. I was chilling downtown, because racking, one of the greatest things that racking graffiti taught me, it took me to all the boroughs. It took me to Flushing. It took me to Elmhurst. It took me to Jackson Heights. It took me to Brooklyn. It took me to Canarsie. So like we would rack during the day, see the spots we would want to hit, and then come back at night. So it was like a fucking full-time shit all time, like all day. And then we would dress fly. And sometimes when you're dressed on the train, you would run into some other dude that collected polo, another rider, and then you get his number, and then you'd go do a deal to trade who knows, you trade like a fucking EOK Swiss knit for a fucking two split hoods and $500, I don't know, something like that. But so a lot of things changed for me. So like racking just, it's it can be pretty negative, but for me, I loved it. I really, really loved it. And I was always a straight edge person. Like, I didn't do drugs. I know a lot of graffiti writers are plagued with fucking drugs and shit, which is ironic because, you know, my graffiti name is Rehab. And shit, man, it's kind of... I remember my boy Nex. My boy Nex told me some crazy shit one time. My boy Nex, we were chilling one time. Next Iraq MSK. So Next was like, I only have two friends that don't do graffiti, that don't do drugs, and they both write Rehab and Attic. So I always remember that. But
how'd you come up with that name,
Rehab?
Yeah,
shit, I mean, at the time I was you know, I was writing Shame, and then I wanted to have a tag that had an acronym or some shit like attached to it. So I don't know, I was just thinking of corny toy shit, and then I came up with Rehab, and I was like, Rehab stands for wrecking every house and building. And at the time I thought that shit was cool when I'm like 17 years old. Like, in retrospect, maybe I would have changed it, but, and it just changed. And I think Rehab was just, it wasn't a cool sounding name, to be honest, but I think when you told somebody you wrote Rehab, they will remember it. And it's like, why the fuck would somebody write Rehab? And I think it's kind of like the same thing, like, when I made Earsnot. That's not a tag you're going to forget. Like, why the fuck you would write Earsnot? It was just so crazy. So, yeah, so.
And when did you were doing all this boosting for bread and as a lifestyle, all the people you chose with are doing it, and you're just, you know, really getting into it, learning the ways, probably organizing yourself. I had to imagine, you know, furthering it. When did you start taking steps back, assuming that you don't do that anymore? When did you start, you know, chilling out from that? Because you can't do that forever.
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. But man, it took years, dude. It took shit. You would have to fast forward until like when I went to Japan. I know dudes in the game, late 40s, 50s, go hard body, and kind of like, it's like martial arts, kind of like you evolve and you get better. So maybe I started making $50, maybe I started making $200. And then you eventually, like by the time I met Earsnot in 96, 97, 98, we were making definitely lowest $1,000. Earsnot was way more aggressive than me, so he was probably making like $2,000, $2,500, $3,000 maybe, a day, cash.
I thought you were going to say a week.
No, a day, cash. And then we were living that every nice New Year's Eve type of lifestyle, just party and shit, like, eat whatever we want, take cabs wherever we want. And, that's what it was. And it just kept, and the crazy part is, I don't know how we would be broke. It was crazy. Like, I would just be broke. Like, the next day I would have like, there was times Airstein made $2,000 and he would ask me to give him money to get on the train the next day. And I'm like, yo, dude, you got a gambling problem? I don't understand. But it was, we were just, you know, we were mad young. We were reckless with money. So that's, it's, you know, I guess to answer your question, it's like, for me, it took me living in another country and, you know, wanting to change my life. Like, when I moved to Japan and I started teaching English and doing stuff, you know, I think that's when I felt like I quit.
So tell me about that. What's the deal with you moving to Japan and your relationship with that place?
Shit, the best place ever. At the time, we gotta fast forward a little bit. Already Iraq Crew is a full fledged thing, and we're all chilling together. It's me, Sace, Earsnot, my boy Glace, Sam, Seaman, all those people were just fucking chilling. Fanta, everybody. So, at that time, A-Life came out. And A-Life was, before the sneaker store, there was, you know, it had a retail shop. And My boy Jess, Jess TBT, worked there, and kind of like, Jess was like a fucking genius. He like, all the cool graffiti writers were attracted to that spot, and like Jess wasn't like scared like we were racking. So we would rack all day, go to A-Life and leave our shit there and go back and rack more. So it was kind of like our locker or some shit. And Jess was just dumb cool. And so that's the first time I saw people like doing Photoshop and using Illustrator. And I was fascinated by it, but like, I'm like, dude, I'm making $1,000 a day. I don't got time to be doing this shit. But yeah, going to A-Life and then hanging out at A-Life with Jess and Rob and Arnaud and Tammy at the time. Upstairs, that's when Jess introduced me to this guy named Komura-san from Japan. He was like he was a buyer for A-Life, and he had like he was maybe distributing or carried A-Life in his store. And at the time, I had a Japanese girlfriend, but I didn't know that much about Japan, like not that much. I was obsessed with whatever I was doing. And he was like, yo, if you come to Japan, I'll give you a job. And I was like, okay. But I never thought I would go. And then she hit me up and she's like, yo, let's go to Japan. Let's go there for the summer. And for me, the big push was when 9/11 happened. When 9/11 happened, so our Bumpy, backtrack, me, our Bumpy, at the time, we were racking, like, vitamins. Vitamins was huge. Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, that was big. Shout out to my boy, Nolk. But we were racking vitamins, me and Irsnot, and our Bumpy was in Wall Street. And sometimes I would bump off, make my $1,000 or whatever I made that day. Then I would go to World Trade Center and then eat lunch there. So I wasn't. And then my old roommate at the time, Sam, worked at Wall Street also. So I'd be there to hang out with him. So when 9/11 happened, I actually moved to Queens. I was living in, I just moved to a house in not Astoria, Steinway.
Okay.
I moved to a house in Steinway. And dude, when that shit happened, I was like, yo, that could have been me. I would eat lunch there. I'd be there like at 11 a.m., 10 a.m. sometimes. And I was like, yo, if I would have died, I never went anywhere in my whole life. Nowhere. All I did was fucking rack mad shit and do a lot of graffiti. And to be quite honest, like, that Iraq shit is cool now when you pan back. But to be quite honest, we felt like fucking losers. Like, I felt like I got to do something with my life. Because, you know, I didn't feel like I was changing anything. Irsnot didn't feel like he was being a legend. Sims was the only person that noticed it. Sims, VGL Iraq, Sims was like, yo, this is the best time of our lives. You don't understand what's happening. We were like, yo, shut the fuck up. Sims was like, yo, you don't understand. We're going through the best moments of our entire lives and you guys don't fuck. I just thought it was some crazy high talk. And Sims was spot on. We didn't realize it. I just felt like, damn, I need to do something better with my life, right? I was already at that point. This is like, you know, like 99, 2000. Sims knew it. Sims, he's like, yo, these are the most precious moments of our entire lives and you motherfuckers don't even notice it. And we're like, yo, shut the fuck up. But, yeah, when 9/11 happened, I was like, yo, I want to go somewhere. And then I decided to go to Japan. And when I went to Japan, I went to Fukuoka, which is like the third biggest city. I never heard of Fukuoka in my life. And when I got there, I met Komura-san. And then one thing led to another. I was working with them, had an art show. I started teaching English, and I was being paid like $50 an hour to teach English. And I was like, I don't fucking have a degree. This is amazing. So it was like almost better than racking, because I was like making designs for people, and they were giving me like $500 per design and other shit. And it was just like crazy. So when I got to Japan, I felt like it's like a video game. Like I restarted my life again. And then, but I have all this crazy experience. So when I went to Japan, I wasn't trying to do graffiti. I was trying to, like, just make a new life there. But, like, some of those old habits die hard, man.
So when you went there, you planned on just not writing graph at all and just essentially starting anew? So you didn't write graph while you were over there, or?
I did, but I tried not to. I wanted to, like, ride off into the sunset and just, honestly, I wanted to just delete all my old life. I wanted to just, because nobody knew who I was. Nobody judged me. I was like a brand new person there. And Japan was just, the people are mad friendly, especially Fukuoka. The people were super, super friendly. And man, Japan was really, really good. But I tried to not really write, but then I met local writers, like my boy Zero C, M2D. I met a couple of other writers from Fukuoka. And they, you know, I started writing a little bit and taking tags. And then at the time, Jest TVT went to Japan. So I would see Jest tags around. And when I went to Tokyo, I saw some New York writers, and that blew my mind. I was like, I think the first dude I saw up there was like this dude who writes Serif. I was like, what the fuck is this dude doing here? Then I saw Surf and Mint up there. And then a couple of other writers, but it wasn't too crazy. Oh no, I saw MQ. MQ was definitely up in Japan, and that blew me away. And so, and that takes me back to like when I first started learning about graffiti. Like Trake and MQ were always like up there for me. So when I found out that he was been to Japan and like basically pioneered an entire shit in Japan, that blew me away. That so I started getting the itch again, and I started writing. And like Tokyo, by the time I moved to Tokyo, which was 4 years later, maybe 2004, Tokyo was amazing. It was like, imagine the best black book you could have. It was like Revoke, Rhyme. It was like MQ. It was just like every really good writer that had money to travel would go there and do shit. And it was amazing. It wasn't like the Tokyo that is now. And then I connected with my boy Wanto, my boy Sect. Shout out to all those guys. Yo-chan, QP, all those guys. And Japanese graffiti was highly influenced by MQ. I don't think MQ did it on purpose. He just went there and just did graffiti. But the original graffiti style that Japan had was like some German piecing style, very sharp letters, and it was kind of corny. Suddenly, everybody wants to do these chunky fat throw-ups and take tags. And so at that time I linked up with a guy named Abini. He does he's the guy that everybody bites what do you call those stickers now?
Eggshell.
What's the real name that Abini said? Not disposable. Destructible. They're called Destructible Vinyl. They're not called fucking Eggshell. Eggshell is a brand.
Mm.
It's called Destructible Vinyl. And BNE, I believe BNE and MQ pioneered that, period. They made that shit themselves. And so I met BNE, and then we were hanging out. And that dude was in Japan for years before me. And just fucking, that guy was obsessed. I mean, we had a falling out years later, but at that time in Tokyo, so I was hanging out with him a lot and a lot of Japanese writers. And then, just seeing a different style of graffiti in Japan. And like I feel like I pioneered my thing, my little legacy in Fukuoka, which is South Japan. And at the time, my boy Sabe KST came to Japan and we lived together. And Sabe was doing throw-ups everywhere in Japan, those faces. Shit was dope.
So when you went from New York to Japan, trying to, you know, start anew, had you gotten in trouble for all of the ragging and graffiti that you had been doing in New York before you had left? Was there any consequence that came of any of that?
Was there any consequence that came with any of that? Shit.
Specifically legal consequences.
In New York?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things, if you're really into racking, one of the things that you really notice about racking that you like, that why don't you sell drugs instead of racking, is because if you get caught for drugs, you know, you could, 8 months, a year is probably like the minimum, 8 months, a year, 3 years. Racking, shit, you could go to the bookings and come out that weekend, you know, or maybe you get unlucky, you do 3 months, 90 days, 60 days, 30 days. Most of the time, community service, especially that time. So, unless you were a higher level drug dealer that was moving weight, if you were just some regular ass drug dealer, rackers, a good racker will make more money than you. They just would. Like, I know for a fact, Irsnot did. Dude, he was making like 1,500 to 2K a day times 5 days a week. We treated it like a job. I'll pick up Irsnot at 7 a.m. in the morning to be at the fucking stores at 8 a.m. like we were in a fucking employee. Like, and in fact, dude, some of the shit that we used to do, I used to dress up as a security guard. I found a security guard jacket from like a vintage store. I had that, like a CDC or whatever security. I had these glasses I would wear. I had like a messenger bag and I had slacks and boots and I looked like a security guard, right? And I would walk in and I'd say, I'm the new guard from CDC. I would go to like Rite Aid's and Duane Reade's. And they're like, we didn't request one. Because I know the real security doesn't show up until like 8. And I'll be like at 7. I'm like, oh, I think I'm at the wrong store. Can I use your bathroom? I know it's downstairs. So they let me use the bathroom. I know where the boxes of all their shit is. So I hit them up for all like their fucking test strips, Rogaine, whatever the shit I was getting at the time. And boom, I would make like $500 there and then just leave. And so that's the type of crazy shit that we were on at that time. So it was...
Would you circle the store so you don't run any spots dry?
Usually if I ran that scheme, I wouldn't go back. But then I'll just go back as a regular person and fucking steal this shit anyway.
Yeah.
I think the craziest shit that happened to us, me and Irsnot, when we were racking vitamins. We spent a whole day racking vitamins. We sold it to this fucking Indian named Naveed. Anybody who's in the game from there is fucking laughing listening to this. But this guy named Naveed from like 59th Street. He owned like a vitamin store. We would sell the shit to Naveed, and he was a horrible bumpy. He wasn't our main bumpy. So me and Kunle sold all our shit, made like a couple of stacks, went back racking, and then we saw that dude Naveed come out of his car with all the shit we just sold him, go to another like health vitamin store, and we just washed them. We're like, yo, he just sold them all the shit that he sold this other store. So we waited for him to leave. And we go in the store and steal back the shit he just sold because they just put it on the shelves and went back to him and sold it again. So that was the type of crazy shit that...
And then he probably went back and sold
it. And then he went back and we probably came back a week later and racked it again. So yeah.
When did the laws change? Because you don't just have places that you can sell vitamins to anymore. And if you do, then I'm completely ignorant and unaware of this.
You're probably ignorant and unaware yeah. of this. I hate to break that news to
wow.
you.
Wow.
But... I think just like things like there's not a lot of bumpies, like a fence that people go to these days. And the people that are using fences are usually like drug addicts, people that are on meth, crack, and they need money like that. I think a lot of that shit has probably moved online or whatever. What are the other methods people use?
So when you moved to Japan, you just completely eradicated this racking to that level habit.
I mean, I racked markers and things that I needed and paint, but like I wasn't racking to the level I was. And so Japan was really, really, really like I was so high level at racking. And so like I felt like, you know, I was in the trenches in New York racking. So when I got to Japan, racking was just nothing. It was like a joke. In fact, you didn't have to hide the items. I would walk out with the items in my hand. And because if anybody said something, you would just be like, oh, you know, I'm lost. I don't know where the cash register's at. So, I did some racking there, but not at the level of New York. It was mainly a lot of graffiti and other shit.
Yeah. So moving to Japan, right? Like you were saying, because of 9/11, you wanted to get out. You wanted to experience like a whole different life. You know what I mean? Something different from New York. So moving back to New York, what can you say Japan gave you? Like, did your mindset change? Did you feel like you found what you were looking for, like at that time? Or was it kind of, since you were still painting and doing like things in that street life also in Japan, did it just feel like a different place, you know?
Coming to New York, I didn't come back the way I wanted to come back. I'll tell you that. And so it wasn't like, oh, I'm finally back home. Coming back to New York was, I felt, it's like, imagine you got like a hard drive that you deleted and then you fucking boot your computer up and you realize the shit's still there. So that's how I felt like when I got back to New York. So my story, so midway or towards the end of my living in Japan, a couple of things happened to me that led me to come back to New York, because I was trying to stay in Japan forever. This shit felt like it was like Disney World on acid. It was the best. So I didn't want to move back to New York. I was happy living in Tokyo and just, you know, just chilling. And I was making good money. I had two apartments. It was amazing. But a couple of things happened. A pretty well-known writer from New York popped up in Japan one day, a dude that I know. And he's pretty well-known for snitching on people. Really well-known, actually. Not pretty well. He's very well-known for snitching on people. So, you know what? Fuck it. I'll say the dude's name. His name is Adder. So this dude named Adder moved to Japan. And no, he came to visit Japan. He just showed up unannounced. And he was like, yo, I'm at the airport in Fukuoka. And I was just like, I knew this dude from trading Polo and North Face and stuff. And we would rack. And he's from Brooklyn. And he had beef with this guy named Scuff, Scuff YKK. And to us, Scuff, the people in the Bronx, the people I grew up with, which was like RK, TDK, KGB people, YKK was the enemy. Those were the bad guys of graffiti. So it was like YKK, Ecstasy. They were always dissing people, and I didn't really understand like the fucking politics behind it. But to me, I was taught that's the other side. Those are the bad guys. And so growing up in the Bronx, once you say you're Ecstasy or YKK, I didn't want anything to do with those people. So Adder had beef with them, so I was like, oh, he's a bad, you know, like those are the bad dudes. And rumor was that Adder snitched on Scuff, but I didn't want to believe it. I was like, ah, that's just Scuff making it look like he didn't. So, you know, we were all cool with it. So I think in New York, one of the interesting things about graffiti crews or people is that it's not like West Coast where, like, if you have a problem with my homie, we all don't fuck with you. New York's very interpersonal. It's like, you don't fuck with my friend, but you're cool with me, so I can, like, shake your hand and maybe speak to you. But, like, you know, it's different. Like, people, I feel you got to fuck everybody over individually in New York instead of, you know, there's very few people, or maybe in the 70s it was like that. It was like, you fucked with one of the members of NPC. We all don't fuck with you. But in the 90s growing up, it was a very, like, people couldn't verify information and shit. So, anyway, he was a cool dude. You know, he fucking comes to Fukuoka, and he's like, yo, I want to change my life. I want to do what you're doing and teach English and all this other bullshit. Long story short, he gets popped doing graph. He started wilding out doing a lot of aggressive graffiti there. He did this huge, huge outline on a government building or some shit. And they roll up on him on a bicycle. I think I was in the store at the time. And I see it. I'm like, oh, shit. I wash my hands, clean all my shit out. And I just wait. They talk to him, and they arrest him on the spot. I'm like, fuck. And I just get out the store, and I leave. Like, I wasn't with him because I was actually in the store when it happened. So I was already aware that he had, like, snitching shit. He also had some issue with revs that Espo told me about. But I just didn't want to believe it. I'm like, but he's cool, though. Like, why would he do that? And when I asked him, I was like, nah, I would never do any of that. And then, sure enough, the police show up at my crib a month later with, like, all this crazy evidence that there's no way they could get. And they in Japan, when you do a crime, you got to write your test. You got to write what happened to you in your own handwriting. So they show it to me, and I see his fucking hand style. And it's his hand style, if you know, it's fucking very unique. And so I had to go to court for that shit, and I had to prove to them that I wasn't Adder or helped him, because he did a really long straight letter, like, and it was like an outline, a really, really long one, like some, I don't know, 15-foot long straight letter. And they were like, Japanese police were just like, they couldn't believe one person could do something that big. They were like, nah, two of you had to do it. I was like, it wasn't me. So I had to show them all proof that it wasn't me. And dude, they had my boy Peter Sutherland's book autographed that I'm in. I don't even recognize myself in that book. And the police were like, this is you, right? There was no way they could. That book wasn't in circulation in Japan. Only Adder had it. All this other shit. But anyway, I ended up getting a suspended sentence for like 3 years. And then I don't know what happened to Adder. Adder disappeared. Just never emailed me, never apologized, never nothing. So fast forward a couple of years, I moved to Tokyo. I'm like hanging out with that dude B&E, doing graph, racking a couple of little things. Then just one day, I went to a fucking store, racked pencils, just like a Faber Castell pencil for some shit. And I, the girl I was with, because I would leave the store first. I'm like, yo, stay in the store so people don't know we're together. I left, and when I'm waiting for her, she doesn't come back. When I call her, she's acting all weird and shook. Sure enough, like 10 minutes later, she shows up with the police. And I'm like, fuck. I was like, I could just leave right now, but this is a fucking like $50 pencil pack. And it was already 3 years past my other case. So when I go to the police station, they're like, Zanen, you know. So they're like, we have some bad news for you. They're like, you still have 1 week left on your other sentence. And I was like, fuck, we can't let you go. So that's it. They violated me for that thing. And I ended up doing a bid in Japan.
Wow.
So I ended up getting sentenced to my original sentence, which is 8 months, plus the 8 months that they found in Japan. So, yeah. So that whole adder shit led to that, so me being locked up. So then I was sent to this place called Fuchu Prison, which was where it's their top prison. It's where all the Yakuza's are at, like that.
So you did 16 months at Fuchu Prison.
Yeah, rough. Probably a little bit longer because, you know, you got to go to like the little police station shit, but yeah.
How was that?
Not good. Tell you that much. Not fucking good. Japanese prison is totally different than American prison. It's forced labor. So I worked on a sewing machine for like 8 hours a day. They make you march all day. It's kind of like a Nazi camp. So you're marching like a Nazi all day. There's no commissary. Anytime you write a letter or receive a letter, it takes two months to reach you or some shit. You're fed the equivalent of like a Lunchable per meal because the meals go on what's your height. That's it. They don't care about your weight. Just how tall are you? And that's the equivalent of food that they give you. So you could be 300 pounds, but if you're like 5'9", you're getting 5'9" food.
So, and then you'll become like whatever you, like you won't be able to sustain your weight because of that calorie.
Oh, no. Everyone is, it's like a fucking concentration camp. Wow. Everyone is, and there's no weights. Everyone is depleted. They're very weak. It looks like a concentration camp. People's faces are sunken. At that time, I was working out. I was doing jiu-jitsu, doing all types of shit in Japan. So I was probably like a solid 190, 195, maybe 200. And I think I came out weighing like 145. Maybe.
So people in there, they're not doing calisthenics and shit because you're eating.
You are. They're running. Oh, they forced you to do these fucking like prison Olympic shits once a year. And it's crazy. It's fucking, they bring all these like, I don't know, whatchamacallit. What are they? Diplomats. They bring diplomats from different countries and they all sit and watch the prisoners fucking do tug of war and do relay races and do all types of like Olympic shit. And you have to salute and it's crazy. It's like insane. So, but yeah, in Japanese prison, yeah, I worked on a sewing machine all day. There's no fights really in Japan. Everyone's like weak from fucking not eating. And there's all types of issues where the windows don't close. So it literally feels like you're sleeping in the street. And everyone has frostbite. Every single person. Every single person I knew in my factory had frostbite. Every single person. So I got frostbite on my fingers, on my toes. They were all purple. And the way you have frostbite, you know it. Your hands become super itchy and they're purple. You got to put them in like hot water and do all this shit. So.
That's insane. Were you the only like American in the prison?
There wasn't a lot of Americans. There wasn't. There wasn't a lot of Americans in there. It was a lot of... I tell you one thing. I was one of the few people that had a low sentence. If you make it to that level, you usually have 3 years, 4 years. I met this poor American kid from Brooklyn that I think he went out partying in Roppongi. And he was trying to hop the cab and not pay. And the cab driver took a knife out and he was like in the Navy. And his like reflexes kicked in. And he tried to disarm him. He ended up stabbing the guy and the guy just died. And they gave him life. In prison, and the word for life is called muki. Muki means life, and you're wearing this green uniform, and you have like these badges, almost like you're in the army. That tells you how long you've been in prison, and that also tells you if you're doing life. Like you'll have like a weird star or something in the middle. That means that guy's never coming home. But Americans, I think at 50%, your sentence can be translated and you can fly back at 50%. But like, if you're from like Iran or Africa or Afghanistan or China, no, you're there forever. You're never leaving. So my sentence, I could have left early. But all these Nigerians and people, they're like, don't do that. They're going to put this like weird stamp on your passport that no matter what country you go to, you'll be stopped. And so I just ate my sentence.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So in Japan, is that where you started doing jiu-jitsu and getting into martial arts? Like, how did that come about?
No, I started jiu-jitsu. I mean, I've been watching UFC since UFC 1. So I was looking for a school, and then I finally found out that Hensel Gracie had a school, and it was at Hensel Gracie's old original place. It was like it was like a methadone place or some shit like that. And I remember I just went there. I probably went to Hensel Gracie's in 1999 or 2000, maybe 2000. I went there. It was around the time that he just fought Sakuraba, I remember. And when I went in, it was like Hyen Gracie, Hensel Gracie, Ricardo Almeida, all those people were fucking in the room training MMA. And I'm like, I couldn't believe it's them. Because like, I was like watching Pride. I was watching a lot of Pride shit at that time. And fucking Hensel's in the middle of sparring, comes up to me and like taps me with his boxing glove. He's like, what's up, brother? Take a seat. I was like, holy shit. And, but it was like too expensive for me. I felt, because I didn't know. I was like stupid. I was like, I thought a gym should cost like $50. I didn't like $200 for a gym was like crazy or some shit. So, but, or maybe I don't know. I know I could definitely afford it, but I don't know why I didn't go. But, I remember I was wearing a Sakuraba t-shirt and everybody was like, why the fuck would you come here with a Sakuraba t-shirt? Cause like, I think Sakuraba just beat him or some shit. But then I ended up training with this guy named Mike in the Bronx. I used to train at this jiu-jitsu gym. I forgot the name. But the guy's name was Mike. But there was a public access show called Boricua Fitness. And they had a gym. And inside, this guy named Gus owned it. And this guy named Mike something trained jiu-jitsu there. And he was like a purple belt. And that's my first school I went to in the Bronx. And I trained there. And he was like some just Italian Guido dude. And I believe at the time, the guy who owns Jungle Gym trained there. And the first person I ever sparred in my life with was that guy who owns Jungle Gym. Master Chim, I forgot his real name. But
sparred with meaning like almost like Vale Tudo style?
Obviously oh, no, not like a jiu-jitsu match.
Jiu-jitsu roll?
Yeah.
Okay. How but, was that?
I didn't know what the fuck I'm doing.
Yeah.
It's my first class. And that guy, damn, what's his real name? Justin. His name was Justin. So that dude Justin is like, I remember, they're like, all right, roll with him. And I'm like, what the fuck? So I like squared up with him like I'm doing fucking Vale Tudo. And everyone's like fucking laughing. They're like, yo, if this new guy decks him in the face, I'm a fall, you know, I'm a laugh. Justin double legs me. And I knew how to put, like, you know, my legs around and put the guard. And then he fucking does a can opener on me with his fucking chin. And I don't know if you know anything about a can. Like, it's just, like, not a nice move to do to fucking a new person who's never trained. But that was, like, the atmosphere in that. So.
And you said he was a purple belt?
He was probably blue at the time. He was blue, but he was, like, already, like, a wrestler or some shit.
What year was this?
2000, I think.
How do you think, like, what was the room like? Was it mainly white belts? I know that.
It was white, two blue belts, white belts, and the teacher was purple. So a purple belt was like a fucking wizard to me. Like you know, like, I never seen a black belt, but a purple belt, what a purple belt could do, I couldn't believe it. Like, my goal was like, I just want to be purple belt. I was like, I don't even need to be brown belt. Purple belt was like my ultimate goal.
So you started training, you were training there, and then from there, where did you go?
I moved to Japan at that time. Then I moved to Japan and I started training this place called Wajitsu Keishukai. It's an MMA gym. I trained at the Fukuoka branch. And a famous fighter named Kyle Uno comes from there. And Yushin Okami, who was also, they were both UFC fighters. And it was, you know, like an MMA gym. It was like kickboxing, jiu-jitsu, catch wrestling, a lot of leg lock stuff. So, that's what I trained. So I was there for like a year and a half doing that. And then they threw me into like a tournament. And I did amateur shooto, which is like, I don't know, B class. You're wearing the headpiece and you're wearing shin guards. So.
And then, you were training over there. And then when you came back here, you started training at?
When I came back, no. I trained there. And then before that, I did a match and I got like choked out by some judo black belt. Then I jumped over to Axis Jiu-Jitsu. Once I started training at Axis Jiu-Jitsu in Fukuoka, Wakanda-san. And then when I moved to Tokyo, I trained at the main gym at Axis Jiu-Jitsu with Taka and the twins, these Japanese-Brazilian twins. They're the instructors there. Polio, I forgot the other's name. They look exactly the same. There's no way you could tell the difference. So, but then when I moved back, I started training at Alliance, like Fabio Clemente.
Mm-hmm.
I trained at Alliance, but it wasn't Alliance. I mean, it wasn't Fabio Clemente, but it was Alliance at that time. Now I guess he left it and they're Fabio. So I think that's the school where Marcelo originally, when Marcelo came to New York, he was there at Alliance. And then I trained there, and that's Babs. Babs was the instructor. That dude is amazing. He's also a dope actor. He's in the new Dune movie. You ever seen Dune? He's like the only black person in Dune that the guy fights. But I trained at Alliance, and then I moved over to Marcelo Garcia, which was amazing at the time. And I trained at Marcelo Garcia. It was just like the time schedule didn't work out for me and stuff, but I loved training there. Marcelo was like the nicest man. I think he's like the nicest human being. Like that's the perfect role model. You know, so I trained at Marcelo Garcia, and then I ran into my boy Fernando, Rios TCK, and he was like, yo, I'm training in the Bronx. And then I started training at Bronx Jiu-Jitsu, my boy Junior, and my boy and his brother Nate. And yeah, I did a lot of training there. So.
And then, well, two things. One, with the whole Marcelo thing, I've never trained at Marcelo Garcia's, and I've never, but I went to San Diego and we trained with Joel Tudor at Surf Fight, and like the way that guy moves and seeing him roll with people who I know are higher level,
yeah,
and what he can do to them with very minimal movements, it's you see like there are really levels to black belt. Like there's that quote, like there are black belts and there are black belts.
It's 100% true.
Right? So then I'm like, damn, yo, this dude barely moves. He told me, like, yo, if I'm in your butterfly guard, do anything you want. And then he'll just grab Kimura, flip over, and then doesn't matter. Like, doesn't matter what you do, you get double underhooks, doesn't matter. He's just going to grab Kimura and go from there, right? And he doesn't move much. I came back here, I was just lurking on YouTube, and I seen Marcelo and him rolling.
Yeah.
And Marcelo just absolutely just disassembled him with crazy, you know, like just sheer technicality, and I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah, there's levels, like, you know, I think with anything in life, no matter how good you are at something, there's people that are just higher level. I mean, when you see Marcelo, when I first saw Marcelo roll with Eddie Bravo, I was like, oh shit, how the fuck he's gonna, you know, when, you know, a 10th planet guy. And Marcelo at the time, you know, was being very polite. No, but there's definitely levels to this game, and like, dude, you know, like, it's crazy. I mean, that ADCC where Marcelo popped on the scene and he slept Shaolin and beat, like, everybody. That was just amazing. And even Marcelo Garcia's match with Cron Gracie, epic. So, like, I think, you know, it was a little too far for me, and the Bronx Jiu-Jitsu I was able to go more often, but like Marcelo, I think it's the perfect embodiment of like somebody you would want to be with in Jiu-Jitsu, you know, be like at least.
So what happened, what ended up happening to your knee when you were training?
Oh, I tore my ACL and damaged my MCL at Bronx Jiu-Jitsu. Shout out to my boy, Lewis. Shout out to him for fucking ending my Jiu-Jitsu career. But, I think I was just, we were doing some stupid drills, and then we did like some type of stand-up drill, and I went to hit him with like a judo hip toss, and I did it wrong because I'm not a judo black belt or anything, and my ACL just popped. It sounded like a balloon popping, and that's it. And then I didn't go to the hospital for a month because I was in fucking denial that my ACL, I thought I could just fucking put ice and Vicks vapor rub on that shit and it would like heal up, and it didn't. So
how's it feel now?
It's good now. I could probably, I could drill, but I can't, like, I probably can't roll or do single legs. And some positions, like, I can't put a lot of pressure down on the knee. So, but, you know, I could probably, like, still drill and do light drilling and do technique stuff. So, but, you know, I think when you first start jiu-jitsu, the interesting part about jiu-jitsu is that everyone secretly wants to believe, like, you're Neo from the Matrix. Like, you're the chosen one. And that you're gonna like be good at this and win ADCC and the Pan Ams and be like this new prodigy. And you know, it doesn't always work out like that. You know, it takes a lot of discipline and time in the gym. Like even at Bronx Jiu-Jitsu, there's people I started with that were just not the best people. They were like basically the worst people. They kept coming. They kept coming to class. And those dudes are brown belts, black belts now. So like, you know, I actually think consistency beats out talent all the time. Talent, the thing about talent is that it's attached to passion. And once you lose your passion, you don't want to go. You don't want to do it anymore. But if someone who's consistent, it can be that boring. It's like that turtle story, you know, the turtle and the rabbit. So I've seen that scenario play over many, many, many times. So a lot of those black belts, it's not that they were that great. It's that there was, they're consistent, man. They're super, super consistent. There's this story that, I forgot his name. I've seen this thing on YouTube. You ever heard the story about that guy who's a black belt? He's from Brazil. I think he lost every match until he was like brown belt. Like every tournament he lost. Every single one of them. And then once he became a brown belt, he started winning. And then or maybe he lost until he was a black belt. Something like that. But the point is, he must have lost dozens, if not hundreds of matches, and but just never gave up.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, in just in terms of life in general, when you look at things from the limited perspective of the present, you have no idea what's going to happen in the future. This white belt, blue belt, whatever belt that sucks wicked bad, might just keep coming. Before you know it, he's the high level, the black belt. And it reminds me of what you said, that when you were younger, and you know that Iraq is cool now, but when you look at it, when you were younger, to be frank, you felt like you were a loser. You wished that you could have done something with your life. When you look back at that time period and how it's looked at now and how it's glorified and all these things, what does that make you think? Like you said everyone but Sems was like, what the fuck are we doing? And now it's like the coolest thing. Everyone there, you know, there's currently like, you know, just people trying to interview and all these clothes and art and all of this thing that's popping off. When you thought that it would be nothing,
I mean, I knew Earsnot was super talented. We all knew that, dude. There was people that didn't like Earsnot that wanted to push Iraq. People that didn't like him, because you know, like, there was a lot of shit where like people were homophobic and stuff, and like, and you know, he's like the first male gay person that I became like real friends with. You know, so. I took a lot of shit. People were like, yo, why would you hang out with like a faggot? Or they would call him faggot and stuff like that. And so Iraq was not fucking cool. It's great that Iraq is cool now. But at the time, people were like, yo, you're hanging out with a faggot. Your crew is a faggot crew. All this other stuff. And kind of like that story we were just talking about. Kunle didn't, he had a crazy weird name. He's black, he's gay, in a super homophobic subculture that's super macho. Everyone, the only way you get respect is by fighting. And he slowly just went that way and he just like took his time with his shit. And he had to fight people to get respect and beat some people up. One of the things that's very interesting about his approach about everything is like, no matter how bad people talked about him, no matter how bad his situations were, he just kept going. He didn't stop showing up to class. He just kept going. So for me, like when we were starting, when I met Earsnot, he already wrote Iraq, because that's something he came up with, I think my boy Wack, STF. Wack, shout out to Wack. Wack came up with the name Iraq. But it was not, it was just like, you know, imagine you just become a graffiti writer and you make up your fictional crew. You don't actually think it's going to become a thing. Then when I met Earsnot, I'm like, yo, why do you write Iraq? He's like, because Iraq. I'm like, word, me too. And so I fucking remember when I first met him, I met him on A Street. And when I met him, I think I was my boy VO or somebody. I don't know who I was. And I met him, and that's what I asked him. I was like, yo, do you loot rack? And he's like, no, what's that? I was like, yo. I was like, where do you live? He's like, I'm homeless right now. And I'm like, what? And I'm like, yo, meet me on 59th Street tomorrow on the D train at 8 o'clock in the morning. And this is back in the days when you would tell somebody to meet you and they would just magically be there without fucking you having to text and do all that shit. Next day I meet him. We met at 59th Street. We went to Queens. And we went to Queens and we made money. He must have made like, I don't know, $300 or $400 in powders or whatever, I don't know. And I remember he was homeless at the time and I was just like, yo, what are you gonna do with that money? You're gonna get like a hotel? And he was like, nah, because if I get a hotel, I'm still homeless. And I remember he's fucking homeless. And with that money, he went to Canal Street and bought gold fronts. And I was like, that told me a lot about his character right there. So, but no matter how uncool Iraq was to him, no matter how fucked up his situations were to him, no matter how many people called him a faggot or made fun of him or crossed him out, it didn't deter him. He kept going. And it didn't bother me because I was like confident with who I was. And he was just like, you know, like when he told me he was gay, I think we were like racking. And I'm telling him racking stories like the way I'm talking to you right now. And he's like, yo, by the way, I'm gay. And I was like, what? What do you mean? And he's like, I'm gay. He's like, but don't worry, I don't like you. I just like white dudes who look like construction workers. I was like, yo, as long as you don't disrespect me, I don't give a fuck what you do. Because the way I treated it, it's like, that's your shit. That's like if you're Muslim. That's like if you're vegan. That's like if you like Trump or Biden. That's like if you want to get a vaccine or not get a vaccine. That's your shit. That doesn't have nothing to do with me. As long as you treat me with respect, we're cool. I don't give a fuck. So I've always handled, I think, everything like that. You know, as long as you can, we don't have to agree on certain things, but I feel like as long as you can treat people with respect and dignity and not force your beliefs upon them, that's cool. And so that's how I've always hung out with Kunle. And I even like super homophobic Bronx writers, we'd all be in my boy 8's house, I remember. And dudes would just ask him like gay questions, like crazy, weird shit. Like, yo, you suck dick or somebody else sucks your dick. Like, weird, crazy shit. But these are young kids that are 16, 17, 15 years old. They can't ask. And it's not like now where you could Google internet and find out about homosexuality. They wanted to know. And it was like, everybody was making a joke about it and trying to snap on him. But the reality is these niggas were trying to find out for themselves because they're still young kids. And so I feel like one of the things with Iraq was just like never trying to be cool, just being ourselves. And Kunle, no matter how, what other people thought, he was himself for sure. And I think that's what gravitated everything to it. So like, I think, you know, definitely like the beginnings of Iraq is me and Kunle racking a lot. And then like once Sace came through, originally Sace, I don't think Sace was down with Iraq in the beginning because I remember we would hang out with Sace. And Kunle loved hand style. I love hand style too. Hand style's my shit. Like growing up, my boy Sabe KST, it's like my favorite hand style. Him and Cost KRT and Twist are my favorite hand styles. And I remember when I met Sabe, I was like, yo, how do you get good? How do I get as good as you? He's like, buy a notebook, a 99 cents notebook, get a very, 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 very thin pen, and fill every page top to bottom with small tags. And it's like, you'll probably make, you know, like 10,000 tags and you'll be good. And I took that literally and I just wrote with a very like sharp micro pen my tag. Thousands and thousands filled up notebooks. And that's the only way like I was able to get good. Because I could draw good, but I couldn't understand why my drawing ability didn't translate to hand style. It was a totally different skill. So Kunle loved hand style. So I remember Sace's hand style was just not good at the time. And Kunle would be like, don't fucking write next to me. You're horrible. Like, we would, you know, but we were just like, and then eventually Sace leveled up, and then, you know, he was like officially part of Iraq, and Sace took it to another level. He was going to LA and like bridging the gap with a lot of writers from like San Francisco, LA, even Europe to New York. And he's like, he's the one that I think he brought Skirt and Fanta to New York, or he helped with that. And so, but man, Iraq, man, it's one of the, yeah, it's one of those things that, man, it didn't feel like we were doing anything cool. It didn't feel like we were doing anything important. But you keep at it after a long time, and I think people see your body of work. It's like one of those, like, you know, sometimes that there's those weird obscure artists that nobody knows about, and then like when they're 7 years old, you discover their body of work, and then they're a genius. So it's one of those things that if you look at day by day, month by month, even year by year, it doesn't make sense. But when you pan out, you're like, oh shit, this is epic.
Yeah, and now Iraq is like, it's one of the, I feel like it's one of those crews that a lot of crews are legendary, and but as time goes on, things happen and they lose steam. Whereas from my outside perspective, it seems like, if anything, the opposite has occurred, and there's a lot of interest in it right now, to the point where it's like you could think of it on some, it reached black belt level.
It did, you reach know? Black belt level. It did. But it's just like any black belt. It's not an easy journey, man. It's not glorious, man. There's injuries. There's mad doubt and shit. But I think it's the consistency and keep going. But also, like, I think one of the things with, like, Iraq, it's just amazing. I like that all the people in Iraq are individuals that are doing their own shit and kind of a totally separate thing, you know? And, like, my boy Ryan, like, one of the best photographers in the world, Teddy, Kunle, my boy KS, Ben, my boy Glace, they're all, I feel, black belt in their own individual things. And, like, even with the stuff I'm doing now, I remember when the advice Kunle gave me, Kunle Irsnat, was like, I don't care what you do, just make it your lane. So when I finally got into, like, you know, like NFT stuff, I was like, you know what? Maybe I'm not going to be the dope cinematographer that Ben is, or Dan, or I can't be the dope photographer that Ryan is, or, you know, I can't make this great art that Dan Colin does, all this other stuff, but I'm gonna make this shit mine. So when people think of my name, they're like, oh yeah, that dude's been doing NFTs for mad long, and that's his shit. So
yeah, speaking about that, in terms of metaverse, NFT, and all of the, your you know, delving into all of that, I guess we can start with your NFTs. What's the deal with that? How did you get interested in such a thing, and where do you think it's going?
To the moon, baby. Shit, where's it going? How I got interested? Oh, all right. I guess it started, I mean, I've always been interested in, like, tech, especially, like, future tech and stuff. So I was always, like, talking to my boy Katsu about shit. Katsu put me onto Bitcoin, like, in 2011. And he's like, yo, buy this. This is going to change your life. I remember he sent me a YouTube link. And when I Googled it, it said, this is the official currency for Magic the Gathering. I was like, fuck out of here. I'm not going to invest in this. And there you go. But during pandemic, I was just stuck home. I wasn't doing shit. So I was like, yo, I want to just level my mind up. I can't just play video games all day and fucking watch Netflix. So I was like, at the same time, I was chatting with Lush Sucks from Australia. He's like, if you don't know him, he's like graffiti, street artist, whatever the fuck you want to call it. But he does like these dope murals of memes. And they're like, dude, that dude's mastered the art form of memes. Like, memes are like, it's almost its own language.
He's very good.
It's its own language. And like, he's like mastered that shit. And so we've always been talking. And I remember he told me, he's like, yo, I'm gonna start making NFTs. And I kind of, this was, I don't know, was it 2021? Early 2021, I don't know. I think it was like 2020 going to 21. That's, it was 2020 going to 21. And he was like, so in 2020 we were talking about it, and then he was like, I'm gonna make NFTs. He's like, you know I got some bills to pay. And I was like, you know, God bless you, dude, you know, I hope it works out for you. Because he was just like an internet friend, like I didn't know him in real life, so what the fuck am I gonna say? So he hits me up and he's like, I made x amount of money and it's going well. And I'm like, word? And he's the one that, like, like, I was like, yo, tell me what to do and I'll fucking quit my job right now. Like, let me know. And I got on a phone call and he, like, taught me the baby steps of what to do. I was already, like, investing in stocks and I was already investing in cryptocurrency. I already, like, was invested. I already had Ethereum and stuff like that. So I was familiar with blockchain. I wasn't familiar exactly how to make an NFT. So I think he was with Maker's Place at the time. It's like Maker's Place is an NFT platform. So it's a marketplace, I mean. So it's like eBay or Amazon. So when you make an NFT, you have to then decide what's going to be the marketplace. So the most popular one that everybody knows is like OpenSea. OpenSea is the easiest. Like both of you guys can make an NFT today and in 5 minutes, it's on OpenSea. But there's other marketplaces like Nifty Gateway, Super Rare, Maker's Place. Those places require verification and it's curated, so it's not easy to get. So I would say like OpenSea is like Target. Anyone can go inside of Target. And if you're selling clothing, if your clothes is in Target, you're going to make big bucks, right? But it's not guaranteed to be a hit. So, and I feel like Maker's Place and some of these other curated places are more like, you know, boutique shops, maybe like a Saks Fifth Avenue or something smaller, some like cool little shop you'd see in Soho or something. It's not easy to get in, but the cool people who knows what's up go to these places. So anyway, Lush was on Maker's Place. I wanted to be on Maker's Place too. I hit the people up. They were not interested. I don't think they knew who Iraq was, or maybe I didn't talk to the right people at the time. And then he plugged me into, he's like, well, you should hit up this gallery called Super Chief. They're making the first physical NFT gallery. And I hit them up and he was like, I fucking know who you guys are. I know who you are. And they gave us like super respect right away. And he explained to me like what it is to make an NFT and how important it is to market it. Because I feel like making an NFT is like, imagine you want to be like a fucking rapper or an R&B singer. You can make your album today and press it and make a record right here. Who's going to hear it? You got to do that street team. You got to promote it. You got to take it to radio stations. You got to put like hype behind it. So the people that want to put you on, maybe the record labels come through. So the record labels would probably be like your buyers or the whales that come in and buy your stuff. So Super Chief super understood that, and they understood marketing and stuff. So I teamed up with them. Before you know it, we had the first show. We did we were using Oculus Quest 2. We did the world's first live VR graffiti show or session, where it was writers from multiple countries, like United States, Australia, Tokyo, like me, Earsnot, Sot from LA, who's probably the best I've ever seen at VR graffiti, Lush Sucks, and Snipe from Tokyo. We're all in one room together doing a giant wall that none of us have rehearsed. It was just like totally freestyle. And then we ended up doing the show with Maker's Place, the place that I was trying to get to in the first place, which was ironic. And then we sold that wall. So that wall became part of history. It's dope. And then after that, we followed that up with an Iraq NFT show. And that was really amazing. You guys came out to that. It was fucking... And I think it was so... Pretty much everybody I talked to, they were like, I never heard of NFTs in my life until I went to that show. And it was like super brand new. And I think we're the first... I know we're the first graffiti artists in New York City to do an NFT show. I'm sure we're not going to be the last. It's going to be a lot of that shit, so...
What about people who are, they're like, NFT, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, you're buying a digital file. This makes no sense to me. Why can't I just screenshot it? Why can't I just download it? Why would I? How is this the future?
If those people own a PlayStation and play NBA 2K, they need to shut the fuck up. Because they've been doing that for mad years. Because it's the same thing. It's like when you buy your NBA 2K character outfit and stuff. It's essentially kind of like an NFT. You've already kind of been messing, or those skins for like Fortnite. But it's like, why can't you screenshot it? It's my favorite question. I almost don't want to answer it because I want people to keep being ignorant about it because it's so stupid. But I can go and download Justin Bieber's music right now, his entire album. Crispy, clear quality, right? Now, if I go to a record label and I'm like, look, I have his whole catalog. I want to sell it to you. They're like, what? You have Justin Bieber's whole catalog? Bet. Let's do a deal. Then when I go there, they're like, where's your certificate of ownership? Why do you own these? I'm like, oh, no, I just downloaded them. It's like, but, you know, and I say, no, no, but they're really good quality. It's the same thing that you have. He's like, you don't have the certificate of ownership that verifies that you own these. That's it. That's the whole story. So you can screenshot. I can like literally text you the stuff that I upload. But inside an NFT, it's like embedded our certificate of ownership. So when you try to sell it in the marketplace, that's the only way you can sell it. So I guess it's like if you steal a car, you can't really truly sell it because you don't have the deed, right? So I guess, you know, like taking a screenshot is cool, but you don't have that deed to really sell it. So you'll never get, I mean, you're only going to sell it for the stupidest people on earth. So that's probably the main thing.
So you think of it as like, or it is like, almost like a receipt.
It is a receipt and a certificate that you own it. Now, built inside that contract, there's various things that can be like, you own the rights to duplicate this and make it on shirts and coffee cups. But it has to be on that, you know, every contract's, you know, kind of different. But it mainly gives you the right to resell this item at whatever you want to. But I think one of the most important things about NFTs is the rights. So when you sell an NFT, if you sell it for $10,000, I get, I guess, 80% of that money comes to me. Now, if you're the one that bought it, you know someone that will buy it, and you put it up and you sell it for $50,000, I still get a percentage of that sale. I can get like 8 or 9% of that, right? Or even 10%, let's just say, right? I get that. Then this next person flips it for $100,000. I'm still getting those residuals. I'm still getting a percentage, and it's for life.
And you're getting that percentage because you are the original deed owner.
Yes, and it's built into the contract. So I actually think that people probably don't fuck with NFT collectible market, right? It's definitely a boom. I'm not sure if this shit's going to be here to stay. I think a lot of these projects may go to zero, but the ones that survive, it's kind of like the early internet. When the internet boom came out, some of those websites died. They didn't make it. But the fucking Googles or whatever that survived that shit, they're monsters. So I feel like some of these NFT projects right now that people are sleeping on or are available, they're going to be big. They're going to be, especially the ones that have utility, meaning you own the NFT and it also allows you to do extra things, maybe in the metaverse or in real life, like extra perks. Like if you own a Bored Ape, right? Yacht Club. I believe that gives you all these like extra perks to do all these other shits in real life, like attend exclusive parties or like get on like jet planes or all this other shit. So
it's like having a pass.
So I feel like NFTs combined with utility is 100% the future, because it's like, I own this, but owning this lets me do XYZ. Mm. So
that's like it definitely is here, and it's here to stay in some form.
Yeah, whether you like it or not, but I feel you may not like the collectibles market of NFTs, right? But I feel the utility of NFTs is big. So it's kind of like we were saying, like email. Maybe you're like some old school dude that just likes writing letters and sending them out. And you're like, I'm never fucking getting an email address, right? I think one of the big problems back in the days when email came out, government agencies felt it was insecure. It was not secure to send sensitive information via email because it can get hacked. But guess what? Everyone had to get, like, whether you like it or not, you're going to come across that. So like, you may not never buy a monkey or a fucking chubby penguin or some weird NFT shit or my NFT or an Iraq NFT or whatever. You may not get into that. But the utility of NFTs, you're going to run into it. Just how everyone was forced to like run into an email address. So like when you buy a car, the deed's probably going to be an NFT format. When you get a job, that contract's going to be an NFT format. When you buy a house, all that type of stuff. So I feel the utility of NFT is here to stay, and it's the future. So the collectibles market is just the tip of the iceberg of what's to come.
And also what we're seeing right now is also just the very early stages. It's like comparing a Motorola Razr phone to the phones we have now. 100%. It's not even the same thing. And it's like a lot of these, technologies, pretty much all of the technologies that come to be in the early stages, they're kind of like mocked, laughed out of the room, or sometimes they're just completely disregarded. Like books, people before the printing press was widely available, people used to say like, oh, if we have books, like our memories will go to shit. You know, because it's common to fear the unknown and not fear.
When cars came out, horses, people were complaining about the horses, like all the people that sold horses and fucking made fucking horseshoes and all that shit.
Or the first version of the internet, it's like no one, they were searching for people to invest in the internet, and people were like, no one is ever not only going to use the internet, but a computer, that no one's going to use that.
Yeah. It's all like telephones. When telephones came out, the telephone wires, there was people protesting in that there was all the signals and the birds are going to run into them and get electrocuted and all this type of stuff. I think any type of innovation has pushback. When the seatbelt came out, people protested that they were like, they're going to cause you, when you get into accident, the seatbelt's going to rip your guts and all this other type of shit. But it's just part of our life now. So I feel people always push back with change. Nobody likes change. Like, I'm someone that grew up moving. I hated fucking moving because it meant change. So, it's just gonna, one of my boys who's, like, super into conspiracies never wanted a smartphone. They're gonna fucking track me and take all my information. He got to the point where even the burner phones were smartphones. They, like, you know, so he had to finally give up on that paranoia he had.
So, in your opinion, right, with all this advancement in technology, like the metaverse and virtual reality, do you think that it's possible that humanity in the future can come to a point where they just kind of numb out this reality to where they're so comfortable, you know, wearing the Oculus, you know, living in that world, having their own shit in there, essentially creating a new identity, and, you know, all your friends and your job and everything is in there, essentially. So do you think that it's possible in the future that, you know, this world that we're sitting in here, like face-to-face, could come to an end? Like, in your opinion?
No, because it's happening right now. We're literally attached to our phones right now. It's an extension of us. Our phone is literally an extension of what we are now. I just feel like it's going to be enhanced, but it's never going to be some Ready Player shit. Like, I think that's the name of that movie, right? Ready Player.
Mm-hmm.
So it's never going to be anything like that. I just feel it's going to be an ultimate extension of that, but I feel there will be people that entire careers, just like now, there's a job. You're a YouTuber. If somebody's a YouTuber, that's an actual legit job that's lucrative, right? All that means that's an extension of your real life or what you can do. So I feel that VR and stuff, I feel some people will make that their main part of existence, just like some people literally live on YouTube, making YouTube videos all day. Some people are professional gamers that literally game and stream for 17 hours a day, 16 hours a day. They will be that extreme part of us, but I feel that it's just another wrinkle to technology. It's another like layer, another detail added to what we're already doing. Because, dude, you wake up, go to the bathroom. Maybe you're somebody, you smoke a J or something. You check your fucking phone. What did I get email? Oh, let me see what funny things are on Instagram. Am I selling anything on eBay? Let me see what's sold. Or am I fucking, you know, like whatever it is you're doing. Oh, maybe you're a YouTube creator. Let me see. Oh, wow, this YouTube video I just made just went viral. Let me see what my revenue is for this. So I feel VR or the metaverse is just going to be an extension of it. And I still think we're at the baby steps. The fact that the metaverse right now looks like Nintendo Wii from 15 years ago shows you how early we are. I'm picturing the metaverse to really be like Unreal Engine. It's going to be super hyper realistic. And the reason these companies are investing into it is because they see they're panning out and they see the future of it. The metaverse is kind of, as someone that's a gamer, it's a little whack right now. It's not, I wouldn't invite anybody to be like, yo, let's go fucking hang out in the metaverse. And the metaverse is also like, it's a blanket statement because it's like saying the internet.
Yeah.
So, but like, yeah, I guess the popular metaverses are like Decentraland, Sandbox. And I guess those are the two top ones. There's a couple of other ones like CryptoVox or whatever that I recently went to. But all these companies are they're betting that this shit is gonna get crazy. They're gonna, because remember the thing about all these metaverses is that they're not tied in, they're not connected with VR yet. Yeah, right now you have to go to your laptop or gaming laptop to go to these things and move around, and essentially what you can do is people can throw concerts on them and buy art and stuff, but it's not like Facebook level. But it's gonna head to that level. But like, and like NFTs, I like, community is great there, but like I do, one of my main fears, it's not so much that like, oh shit, we live in the VR full time. No, people wanna go eat food, they wanna go hang out, they wanna go, you know, hook up with chicks, whatever it is. You're gonna wanna do that. But it's just gonna be an extent. My main fear is that when social media companies like Facebook fully integrate this and everybody's 100% sold, I think the division that that comes with just being a part of Facebook is crippling for nations, countries, small places. The disinformation that can be distributed through that is going to be crazy. So imagine now we only use Facebook on our laptops or computers, and the disinformation is wild, right? In any aspect, right? Whether you're conservative or you're left or right, it's crazy. So it'll be crazier in fucking VR. So imagine disinformation that you can fucking taste and feel. It's gonna be that's where it's gonna be fucking nuts for me. But we're far.
Yeah, and at the same time, like, who knows what's gonna happen, because those markets. Even you could argue that even the internet itself is an immature market. It hasn't matured yet, and the problem of disinformation, although to some extent it has always been a problem, even when books or folk tales were around. This is just it's a giant game of telephone. Even if we are using the internet, especially when everyone has the power to upload shit, but I think that it would be, there is a method of there's always a solution to something, and I think that in terms of like the companies and shit, it's like, I don't know that much about it, but I just like try to stay up to date and research and shit, and I see every day there's some new shit. There, more and more companies are putting their and some of them do it like on some low shit, like they don't, it's not the biggest thing. Like I know New Balance, Adidas, Nike, StockX, Barclays Center, Brooklyn Nets, like they're all, and they're not stupid, they're doing this,
they have the smartest people working for them. Yes. Like people like 1,000 times smarter than me or you or any of the people I deal with, right? And I'm sure these people have done like they've made their charts and analysis, and they've projected that the growth is going to be insane. So, you know, just how, think about VR. Think how long it took for VR to get. I was a fucking teenager when VR came out. I'm like, yo, in 10 years, it's going to be crazy. It took 25 something years, for maybe 30 years, for VR to get to the consumer level. So it's possible that what we're doing, where we're beginning right now, 15, 20 years from now. So like, I feel like we'll live long enough to see like, oh shit, this got crazy. But I don't think it's gonna be, we're still part of a generation that remembers before this. But the kids growing up now, they're gonna be growing up in like doing homework in VR. Or if you go to medical school and doing fucking some of your assignments or surgeries in VR, mm-hmm. which I'm sure already does happen, it's going to be just super normal. So I think it's just another tool added to the wrinkle of our daily tech lives.
Yeah, and in terms of like the, its potential issues and predicting the future, I feel like that's something that need not be worried about to like a crazy extent, because it's like, no matter what course we take as people, there's going to be unforeseen circumstances. So say we never got into like any type of technology and we just stayed at agriculture. One day something would come, would wipe off 90% of the population, some shit. We'd be like, damn, we should have been technologically innovating. Or if we do get into tech, then there's, let's say, pollution problems. But no matter which way route you take, there's going to be some fucking crazy shit. So it's like, what are we supposed to do? It's kind of like our nature to be always pushing forward.
Yeah, it's like if you watch that TV show, Doomsday Preppers. Mm-hmm. I used to love watching that shit. It's like people who are prepping for the end of the world, and they'll fucking build tunnels underneath their house. They'll stock up on food and shit. And at the end of the episode, they'll grade you on what your shit, and they'll what happens is all these dudes would realize, like, oh shit, I missed something. So I feel like people who are like overly scared of change, no matter how much you prepare, you're going to miss something. It doesn't matter. So like, why worry about the change? I think you should just enjoy the now. You know, like people, you know, like I feel like the future always seems worse for the next generation, whatever. So like the graffiti that I came into that I love, the 90s graffiti, which to me was the best. To the dudes from the 70s, that was the fucking worst era to them ever, right? And the graffiti I'm seeing now, to me, is like, damn, this fucking sucks because it's not my era. So I feel like every era, everybody living in the era, to them, this is the best time. Mm. 70s guys thought it was the best time. Me, I thought it was the best time in the 90s, early 2000s. People who are living now think that's the best time. So I think we get so caught up on trying to remember the past or trying to live in the past. I think it's cool to remember the past, but more importantly, to remember and document the past is important, but to live in the present and plan for the future is the most important thing.
Absolutely. Yo, if there's anything else you want to say, if not, I got to say it's been amazing and a huge honor to have you on the show.
Yeah, man. Thanks, man. Just I appreciate you guys doing this. I think you guys, it gives me hope for the future to see people like of your age to be so knowledgeable about graffiti and the subcultures involved in it. It's just, it blows my mind. So, man, shout out to you guys and keep doing your thing.
Thank you so much,
bro. Thank you so much, man. It was an honor.
Peace.
Yep.